Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Protesters gathered today on Boston Common to voice their concerns over a proposed natural gas pipeline that could slice across the western part of Massachusetts.
And earlier this week, protests over the Kinder Morgan pipeline struck even closer to the governor's office when three members of an environmental advisory committee to the Patrick administration resigned. They said the governor has adopted policies, including the pipeline, that undermine the state's efforts at cutting its greenhouse gas emissions.
In a moment, we'll talk with the representative from the Patrick administration. But first, we're joined by Penn Lowe, a lecturer on environmental policy at Tufts University Department of Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning. Penn, along with George Bacharach and Peter Shattuck, resigned from the 18-member Environmental Advisory Committee. Penn Lowe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you were on this committee, and you and George Bacharach and Peter Shattuck were all quoted in the Boston Globe today. And George Bacharach said something interesting. He said, "We won't be played. Don't use us." I presume he meant the committee, the advisory committee, as window dressing. So why did you and the others resign this week? Why do you think that the governor was using you as George Bacharach says, as window dressing?
Yeah, so, I've been participating on advisory committees to the Global Warming Solutions Act now for the last 5 years or so. And I would say for the first several years where we were charged with helping the administration develop its climate plan to get to 2020 goals, we had a wonderful process. There was real dialogue, debate. There was a wide diversity of stakeholders at the table. In the last 2 years, we've turned towards implementation, and that's what this committee is that we just resigned from. Increasingly, we found ourselves in that setting, not really able to talk about some of the most critical issues that are facing the Commonwealth in terms of whether we can achieve our Global Warming Solutions Act goals.
Not being able to talk about them in that, what do you mean by that?
We just weren't given any space to really deliberate over them, and it was becoming increasingly clear that we were just being appeased and strung out in the process.
So appeased by whom, though?
So these are folks in the administration who I respect highly and think that, the administration overall has, there are some things that will be true legacies of the Patrick administration, Global Warming Solutions Act being among them, but now that legacy is potentially being diminished because we have things like moving ahead with developing these natural gas pipelines. This infrastructure is something that decisions now are being made that will affect the next 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
You don't put a pipeline in place and not use it. And meanwhile, we haven't really adequately explored what all the alternatives are and how do we really do renewable energy generation and how do we, in fact, meet the goals of the climate Global Warming Solutions Act. That's what we thought we signed up for with this committee.
Well, we have a little bit of tape of the governor speaking today about that Kinder Morgan pipeline in particular. Let's listen.
I'm not one who believes we shouldn't have any new natural gas. I think there are pressures that we have as a way to bridge to a carbon-free future as coal goes offline. So I think that's wise. But there isn't actually a proposal in front of any agency at this point. And when the process starts, all those folks who have a point of view will have an opportunity to be heard.
So, Penn Lowe, I mean, respond to that. First of all, the governor is saying there's no proposal yet for a pipeline. And second of all, why shouldn't there be new natural gas resources as other sources such as coal go offline?
Yeah, coal going offline is something that people have been talking about since the 90s. And, at one point, natural gas was thought of as a bridge fuel to a sustainable future. But time has advanced. We're in 2014 now. We have 6 years left to get to a 2020 target of 25% reduction in emissions, and we're trying to head towards 80% reduction in emissions by 2050. You know, it's hard to imagine getting there while putting in place more fossil fuel infrastructure, because that, like I said, it represents a financial investment and where people are going to want to see the return.
Yeah.
You don't invest in something like that and just let it sit around.
Well, sorry for jumping in here, but I did want to ask you, I mean, you and George Bacharach and Peter Shattuck have been in this world for a long time. So when you take objection to what the government's doing, it should be noted. But on the other hand, I also note that it was Governor Patrick himself who signed the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2008. And we were looking at state numbers today, and it looks as if between 2007 and 2011, Massachusetts dropped its carbon emissions by roughly 11 million metric tons. Now, if we were to keep up that pace, it seems as if we would be on track to hit the 2020 goals at least.
Yeah, there's a temptation in this work to think that if we just chip away at this, you know, several percent a year, we're going to get to the 80% reduction. But, you know, 80% reduction is a major transformation of our economy and the way we live and produce things and consume things. It is not a linear process. We have a plan that goes through 2020 that we're only the recent report that was submitted shows that we're only 11% of the way by 2011. So, you know, we potentially could get there, but there are some serious questions ahead about, you know, things that are that we resigned because we weren't able to talk about, you know, what will the role of big hydro from Canada be, for instance. This is a major subject that the administration has put forth through the Clean Energy Resources Bill that's in the State House right now.
Right.
You know, they're banking on it. We don't think it's appropriate to put that much emphasis on imported big hydro, which has all kinds of issues related, you know, not only to the communities that may be impacted where they're being flooded over for these big hydro dams. But also, you know, we think there's more potential, and the state even has its own work that shows that, you know, we can do more.
We can
here
do
in Massachusetts.
Indeed. Penn Lowe, professor of the practice at Tufts Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning Department. He resigned this week from the governor's Global Warming Solutions Act Implementation Advisory Committee. Penn, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, let's turn now to Mark Sylvia. He's the Massachusetts Undersecretary for Energy at the Executive Office for Energy and Environmental Affairs. Undersecretary Sylvia, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So first of all, respond directly to what Penn Lowe just said, that basically he and the two other members who resigned just felt as if they weren't being heard and just being appeased by members of the governor's administration, that their suggestions about how to meet those emissions targets weren't being taken seriously.
Sure. Well, let me start out first, given the opportunity to just say that we certainly appreciate the contributions made by George and by Peter and Penn during their tenure on the Implementation Advisory Committee. The IAC has played a very important advisory role regarding the implementation of the Global Warming Solutions Act, the Clean Energy and Climate Plan that Penn just referenced, as well as helped to identify numerous supplemental strategies to help us meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals.
So I take your point that you appreciate what the committee is doing, but what about what Penn Lowe specifically said, that he and George Bacharach and Peter Shattuck felt that they weren't being listened to?
Sure. I think it's certainly wrong to suggest that the administration or the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs did not listen or solicit feedback from every member of the IAC, whether individually or in their role. We've had the great opportunity to meet a number of times with members of the IAC, including George and Peter in particular, as it relates to the Clean Energy Resources Bill. But it's also important that throughout the entire process, we've had a number of IAC meetings over the last several years and discussed each one of these topics. And most recently, on July 17th, the Secretary, Maeve Bartlett, was at the meeting to speak specifically about the Clean Energy Resources Bill, as well as the regional dialogue that's ongoing with the other five states to really talk about the challenges we face from an energy perspective, both in terms of reliability, cost, and our GHG reduction goals.
But it seems as if they had very specific complaints, though, that, for example, I mean, and then this is a rather serious one coming from these three people who have been part of the Massachusetts environmental movement for decades, that the Patrick administration hasn't done an adequate evaluation of alternative energy projects, per se, to not only keep us on track for those 2020 goals, but that 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions that Penlow was talking about by 2050.
Well, again, we would respectfully disagree. I think, as you heard Penn mention earlier, the Clean Energy and Climate Plan, which really lays out the pathway for us to meet our 25% reduction by 2020, lists a number of different ways for us to reach that goal. Energy efficiency, of course, as you know, is a big one, and has been, we're ranked number one 3 years in a row in energy efficiency. But another area that is clearly stipulated in the plan is clean energy imports. And this Clean Energy Resources Bill came out of that particular strategy that's in the Clean Energy and Climate Plan that ultimately the IAC is helping us to implement. So it's not as though the Clean Energy Resource Bill is something that came out of nowhere. In fact, the Clean Energy Resources Bill is a result of one of the very specific strategies that's called for in the Clean Energy and Climate Plan. And the focus is not just large hydro. Large hydro is a part of that. The bill that has been proposed would be both for renewables like onshore and offshore wind and solar, and also a large-scale hydro. So it's a real focus on helping us to meet our greenhouse gas emission goals, that 5% that's in the plan and that I spoke of, but also to tackle very real reliability and cost issues.
Gotcha. Well, Mark Sylvia is the Massachusetts Undersecretary for Energy at the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. Mr. Sylvia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And more now on the environment and a strategy to reduce carbon emissions. Today, Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland is introducing legislation that would require coal, oil, and natural gas companies to buy permits for each ton of carbon in the fuels they sell. So a carbon tax. But in this plan, the government would auction off the permits and hand the proceeds straight to the American people. Dividends for every man, woman, and child. So a plan to reduce carbon emissions with tangible benefits for American families right now. Among the supporters of this approach is Jim Boyce. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He wrote an op-ed about it today for the New York Times, and he joins us now. And Jim Boyce, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So tell us what you like about Van Hollen's proposal, this idea to pay dividends to every woman, man, and child in America.
Well, I think there are two reasons why I find this idea quite appealing. One is philosophical, and the second is political. The philosophical reason is that what a bill like this puts into practice is a notion which I think is pretty widely held among people in this country and around the world, which is that the gifts of nature don't belong to any individuals or firms or governments, that they belong to everyone in common and in equal measure. And that's a principle which this bill embodies with specific reference to the limited carbon absorptive capacity of the biosphere, or at least our country's share of that capacity.
Right.
The principle it implements is that this belongs to us all, and if we're going to, as I believe we must do, charge for using that scarce resource, it's the people who deserve to receive the money rather than any more specific interests. The political appeal rests in the fact that if we do put a price on carbon, it's going to have very visible and important effects on households around the country. As you know, the single most visible and politically sensitive price in the United States is the price of gasoline. It's advertised in 12-inch high numbers on street corners across America. And as a carbon pricing policy goes into effect, people are going to see those prices going up. They'll also see their electric utility bill prices going up and so on. And one of the great challenges of implementing a climate policy will be retaining durable public support for that policy, even as it begins to have noticeable pocketbook effects. And it seems to me that the most logical and really feasible way to retain that public support is to dividend the money back to the people.
So this would literally be a cash payment to every American, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Every man, woman, and child with a Social Security number in the United States. That's the way the bill's written.
Now, it's a new idea in relationship to a carbon tax, but we've seen this kind of dividend system in place in Alaska. It's been there for a long time. Every citizen of the state of Alaska derives benefit from that state's oil that's in the ground. Is that how it would work? I mean, literally, if you're born an American, have a Social Security number, you get a check.
That's right, or more likely an electronic transfer, which
sure.
is the way most recurrent federal payments to individuals are affected these days. Yeah, this is not rocket science, as I say in my op-ed piece. I mean, Alaska's been doing it since 1982. There's an online form on the website of the Alaska Permanent Fund where Alaskans can sign up to receive their dividend payments. But there is one important difference, which is worth noting, which is that in Alaska, this case, the money comes from royalties on pumping oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that provides as sort of an incentive to the public is to pump more oil. The more oil you pump, the bigger your dividend check.
Yeah.
Whereas Congressman Van Hollen's bill creates precisely the opposite incentive. The tighter the cap on emissions, the higher the price will be of the permits, and therefore the more money will be available to pay dividends back to the public. So what this will create is an incentive to ratchet down our use of fossil fuels as opposed to producing more oil in the case of Alaska.
One of the things you said in your op-ed piece today, which I found intriguing, is that sort of one of the challenges in sort of exciting people to care about the future in this way is that it's the future. I mean, we have sort of current needs now that we're worried about, whether it's our own pocketbook issues or what have you. This is a way that sort of pays a dividend now in the moment for improving the planet in the future.
That's right. What it manages to do is really combine two or maybe even in some people's eyes, three attractive features. The first and most important, the purpose of the bill, is to do our part to protect the planet and its environment for future generations. But at the same time, it protects the incomes of American households, working families. It makes sure that the middle class is not penalized in this process. And in fact, it benefits the middle class and it benefits low-income households because for these groups of the population, their dividends will be larger than what they would pay in higher fuel prices. So that's a second advantage. It provides an upfront monetary benefit quite independent of the additional benefits of a cleaner air and a cooler planet. And finally, a third advantage in some people's eyes is that it achieves this without expanding government. In fact, the effect, as I explained in the op-ed piece, is to somewhat reduce the size of government. And because many Americans are deeply suspicious of anything that smells like bigger government, I think this has the potential to win support across the American population to a degree that previous efforts to formulate a climate policy have failed to achieve.
Mm. Listeners, we're talking to Jim Boyce. He's a professor of economics at UMass Amherst. He wrote an op-ed in the Times today about a carbon tax that would pay every American a dividend. We're going to expand the conversation a little bit, and let me introduce Gilbert Metcalf. He's a professor of economics and the director of the graduate program in economics at Tufts University. He co-authored a study called The Design of a Carbon Tax. He's for it, but thinks there might be a better way to spend that money than through dividends. And Gilbert Metcalf, welcome to you. Good to have you.
Thanks. A pleasure to be here.
I'd love you to respond to Jim Boyce's support there for Chris Van Hollen's idea of a carbon tax that pays dividends. Why are dividends not the best way to go?
Sure. Well, first, let me just totally agree with Jim on the need for carbon pricing, and I do want to applaud Representative Van Hollen for putting this bill forward. I think auction carbon permits is a great idea. So is a carbon tax. The key point here is that we want to put a price on carbon so its cost in the market reflects its true cost to society. I think where I differ from Professor Boyce is that the dividend approach gives up the opportunity to improve economic efficiency while addressing carbon concerns. So we can give the money back in this dividend check as is being proposed, and that really has a very strong equity impact. It's very progressive. The value of that money to a poor household is clearly greater than that to Warren Buffett or Bill Gates. But using the revenue, some of the revenue, to lower tax rates can really help with improving economic efficiency and contributing to economic growth. And at the end of the day,
wait a minute, are you saying that using the money to restructure the tax code is more progressive rather than giving a check to everybody?
No, I'm simply saying that we have different needs, and there's a trade-off between equity and efficiency.
I see.
But it's not an either-or question. We can do with. I think there are ways to contribute to both equity and efficiency rather than this approach, which only focuses on equity.
I see. So what
I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
So I think of this as we need a three-legged stool, and the first leg is equity. And first off, let's be clear that we want this to be revenue neutral so that we keep the issue of climate policy separate from the debate over the appropriate size of government. That's my view. So I think my concern with a policy that actually spends more than it takes in is that it will increase the deficit, and that could reduce support from some Republicans potentially. But here's the three-legged stool. The first leg is equity. You want to set aside some of the revenue to address the need of low-income households who will face higher energy bills, and you can do this in a variety of ways. The second leg addresses transitional concerns of a few especially hard-hit industries, and here I'm thinking about older coal miners for whom it's going to be very difficult to retool. And then the third leg is efficiency. We can use some of the revenue to lower income tax rates. And if we do this, we address equity, we address efficiency, we get economic growth, we have a just solution, and we can build a political coalition to actually get this reform implemented.
All right. Jim Boyce, what do you think? What do you think of Gilbert Metcalf's idea about using that dividend just a little differently?
Well, I think there are people who have various ideas about how the money should be used. But I think the primary objective here, which we should never lose sight of, is to get a politically durable climate policy in place, one that will retain the support of the American public throughout the period of the clean energy transition. We're talking about 30 or 40 years to achieve this. Mm-hmm. So we need to have legislation that won't be overturned or repealed if control of the White House or control of Congress or the Senate changes during that period of time. We need to have legislation that is so strongly supported by such a wide and representative swath of the American public that it cannot be overturned, in the same way that Social Security and Medicare have been politically durable. And part of that durability comes from their simplicity and from the universality of the coverage that they provide. It's provided to everybody. There's no means testing. We're not providing assistance only to the deserving poor. And I think, I agree with
Jim Boyce. I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to jump in because we're just plain out of time. But Jim Boyce is a professor of economics at UMass Amherst. You can find a link to his op-ed piece on this subject at RadioBoston.org. Thank you so much. And Gilbert Metcalf, director of the graduate program in economics at Tufts University. Thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Well, coming up, an entirely different kind of green story. We head to Minuteman National Park in Concord for some fresh zucchini. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.